Hey folks, welcome to Newsprint Commando. This is a Pacific Tuesday edition of the show. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet me at Teal Productions or News P Commando on Facebook and Blue Sky. Teal Productions has a presence. I am indieman at gmail.com. Indie is I-N-D-I-E. Oh, and backing up, Teal is spelled like the color, T-E-A-L. And the website, comicbooknoise.com/TNC Tango November Charlie. Now, the books that I'm looking at are all those put out by Pacific Comics for their January 1983 publishing date. And they include, and I believe that this is all they include, but if not, I made an error. Pacific Presents issue number 2. The Silver Star issue number 2. Star Slayer, The Log of the Jolly Roger, issue number 6, and Twisted Tales, issue number 2. So starting off, we will look at Pacific Presents, issue 2, the first story, which is about two-thirds of the book, the first two-thirds. It is Rocketeer chapter 4, scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Mr. Dave Stevens. Well, scripted, pencil, yes, inked and lettered. Colored, I'm sorry, there we go. Colored by a person or persons unknown. No record of who that might have been. Our dramatis personae include Cliff Secord, who is himself the Rocketeer, Betty and Peeve, his sidekicks, as it were, Ham and Monk, a couple ne'er-do-wells, and a couple other individuals. Let's see, did I write their name down? Yes, here we go. Marco and Doc Savage. But not that Doc Savage. But maybe that Doc Savage. And something I think that I have failed to do a lot of times is indicate I am looking at the actual book itself. I am fortunate enough to have a copy. But if not, you can find this particular story, Chapter 4, reprinted in a variety of American reprints. You can find it in the Rocketeer from Graffiti Designs, the 1985 issue, the Eclipse Rocketeer series, also from 1985, the Rocketeer The Complete Adventures Deluxe Edition from IDW, 2009, the Artist's Edition, Dave Stevens The Rocketeer from IDW, 2010, the Rocketeer Adventures, IDW, 2012, issue number 1. So, a variety of places there. And the second story, I'll get to that when I get to that second story. But we open up here, and this is chapter 4 already. So we got the introduction and the introduction of Secord to the rocket pack and helmet that would become iconic as the Rocketeer in the first chapter. Second, third chapter, we find out that there is more to the history of the jetpack, and there are more individuals than just Cliff Secord interested in it. There are two opposing sides, Cliff being essentially a third side as far as people vying for this rocket pack. So we open up here, and we see that someone is being interrogated. They have been given a truth serum, and his name is Werner Guptmann, G-U-P-T-M-A-N, and Guptmann. He's a German agent, and he is being interviewed by American agents. And they find out that he, as an agent of the Germans, and by extension, the Germans themselves. Now, this is the early days of World War II, or maybe right before the declaration of World War II. I don't recall if we are given a year. Thinking back quickly, I don't remember one in this story, but I don't, three other chapters. Yeah, I don't remember, but it's very, very early in the war, if not right before the war. So the Germans are interested in Cliff because he has this rocket pack. Well, the Americans are as well. So now Cliff is trying to dodge everybody, but still keep and potentially use the rocket pack. Dog just wants to make some money. You know, that's all he's about. That and keeping his girlfriend Betty, which sounds very familiar if you're familiar with the 40s and 50s, a famous female individual named Betty. It is meant to, I don't know if it's meant to just look like her or actually to be her, her being Miss Betty Page. But Dave Stevens did a remarkable likeness of Betty Page. It looks just like her. May not exactly be her in the story, but maybe it is. So Cliff just wants to keep her happy. And then Peeve, whom I mentioned at the top, is a friend of Cliff's from the airport-ish area. Peeve is a mechanic, nay, inventor, maybe. But he's a friend of Cliff's either way, and has helped Cliff keep his airplane in the air, which is Cliff's current job, although he has lost it at the beginning of this chapter, we find out. He was a stunt, he was an aerial acrobatist, let's say. He flew planes in air shows doing all kinds of gymnastics, calisthenics, whatever you want to call them, that an airplane does. That's what Cliff did. But he has now been fired because of all the shenanigans that have been following him around lately in the Germans and the Americans and whomever else, you know, maybe the Manchurians, trying to get a hold of this rocket pack that he had that he really wasn't supposed to have. It wasn't intended for him, but he got it and saw that it could be useful, and so he's hung on to it. So Cliff opens. He is bemoaning his plight at Tamale Ice Cream. Let's see. It doesn't give us the name. It's it's inside a giant pug dog, okay, that's sitting with a pipe in its mouth. And you go into the little ice cream shop through a door in its chest as it's sitting looking at you. You would have to see the picture. It's really an interesting ice cream parlor. But he's talking to the woman here, and he calls Betty. He gets upset because Betty says she can't immediately drop everything and help him, be with him, whatever. Cliff fusses a little bit, which, surprisingly, he's pretty open-minded about what Betty's doing. She's doing artistic photography, let's call it, which even nowadays, I think a large portion of the populace would call it pornographic, although it's not sexually explicit. Let's see, am I using those words? I mean, she's not doing movies. She's doing pictures. And for those of you that are familiar with the career of Betty Page, you know what kind of photographs she was a model for. And Cliff is upset that this is what she does. But yeah, I don't know. That whole relationship just struck me and continues to strike me as just kind of an interesting relationship, period, much less for its time. Cliff is very open-minded about these things, which perhaps is an extension of Dave Stevens, his creator. I don't know. But so Cliff goes to Peeve. Last time he'd used it, Cliff had banged up the rocket pack a little bit. And Peeve worked on it and improved it. And it is a sweet-looking piece of machine now, much better than what the original design was. So they go back and forth a little bit about some things that Peeve has, some improvements that he's made, but also some discoveries that it came with the actual physical plans. And I think there was a knapsack along with the backpack and the helmet. And Peeve is showing Cliff that there are some operational grips, like hand grips, and they have rudimentary controls on them. Now, how they connect to the rocket pack, I have no idea. I guess they must be radio controlled at this time, because I don't see any wires, which radio controlled in the late 30s, early 40s, that'd be pretty cool. But so Peeve is trying to tell Secord about all of these new things, and Cliff just runs and he gets dressed, puts on his rocketeer leather jacket and the really cool helmet. It's got a fin on it that helps him, you know, stabilize and control, and slaps on some gloves with these hand grips to help control it. Jumps up, not really listening to Peeve. He being Cliff, wants to get away from everything that's bugging him, and zooming around through the air is the way that it does. It clears his mind, apparently. Puts him in that zen place, you know? Which I don't know. Maybe it would if I could do that. Maybe I would zen out also. I don't know. I kind of don't think so. But, you know, that's just me. So he's flying around and it doesn't work out too well. He crashes to the ground. He recovers. He crashes, but he doesn't damage the rocket pack this time. He just falls flat on his behind. Changes to Cliff Secord really quick. Goes back to his place and finds a couple dudes here waiting for him. And the dudes are in the persons of, daggone it, I keep missing where I wrote this down. Ham and Monk. There we go. Ham and Monk. One is a dandy dressed gentleman, tux and tails and hat and flower and cane and monocle. And the other is a big, the other looks like the Neanderthal kind of character from the early Metamorpho comics at DC, the Neanderthal that the doctor had discovered or had enhanced. What I forget exactly what that story was, but this character puts me in mind of that Neanderthal character with the, he's got a really thick neck and short and squat and big head. He's the muscle. Monk Ham is the dandy over here sitting, and they are looking for Cliff. Asks him where the rocket pack is. He says, well, I left it with my boy. He's working on it. And he gives them an address. They zoom off to the address and they find out that it is Betty's address, and they break into her taking her adult pics. And so that puts everybody kind of on edge with, Ham here kind of hitting on Betty. Betty's like, oh no, who sent you? Oh, okay. I know where you need to go. And she gives them an address. And this address turns out to be Peeves' address. Well, Cliff is there. Betty calls them about 20 minutes after she sent the two dudes, which I don't know why she waited. This whole relationship in my mind between Cliff and Betty frequently is used to further stories rather than attempt to resemble what I think would be anything realistic. And I know I'm sitting here looking at a comic book. I realize that sounds kind of funny. But I mean, you know, when you write a, typically, unless it's specific kinds of stories and specific kind of comic books, you try to relay real life fairly realistically, okay? But the way that Betty and Cliff go at each other and then don't, they reconcile, or they just presume reconciliation. I don't know, we don't really see them reconcile. They just are better. But then the next page, they go at each other somehow. It's curious. So she sends the goons to Peeves' place, assuming that that is where Cliff is going to be. Then she waits 20 minutes and calls Peeve and gives him the heads up, you know? And so needless to say, Cliff is there and he just wigs out because it's like, well, she sent them 20 minutes ago. That means they're almost here. So he grabs all his stuff, runs out, and gets away. Ham and Monk bust in on Peeve. They throw him around a little bit, ask him where this jetpack is. And he tells them, well, hop in the car. I'll take my car, and I'll take you right to my workshop, you know, where it is. Well, he finds out that Cliff is hiding in his car. When Cliff ran, he didn't run out. He just ran and hid in the car. So to the airfield, where a couple German agents have knocked out the actual pilots of the Locust, a plane that's being tested at the moment. So all of this now is starting to come together. We have German agents in a plane flying, buzzing the airfield, essentially. We have two more, Monk and Ham, who turn out to be American agents who are squeezing in on Peeve and Cliff. They arrive at the airfield, find out that the Ham and Monk find out that the American pilots have been knocked out and replaced. So they go and investigate that, get everybody onto the airfield itself, and then they tell the guards, don't let anyone out. That way, at least they know at the, you know, C-Cord is there somewhere. They know Peeve is there, so Peeve can't leave and do anything. And while Peeve and C-Cord are figuring out exactly what they're going to do, someone else pops up here. Your thievery has cost me a lot of time and trouble. It ends here. And this looks like a military person, and he's got the what are they called? They look like saddlebags in pants that people used to have then, you know, how they poof out right at the thigh. And he's strapped some kind of boots on. But it's a dude, and that's all we see. So we don't know, is he German, is he American? He's spoken apparently real English. It didn't look like they were changing it for us from German, interpreting or anything like that. So Peeve and C-Cord are looking out the door at this person who says, you know, ah, I'm glad I found you. Your running is over. And it ends there. So let me go back to the cover here. It's a nice Dave Stevens cover of Cliff C-Cord with, he's got a light shined on him, and the shadow is of the Rocketeer with the helmet and a very heroic kind of pose. the person casting the shadow, Secord himself, is very afraid, and he's clutching the rocket to his chest. And then after the Rocketeer story, we have a full-page color ad for Alien Worlds issue number 3, which we will be talking about at some point, I'm sure. Let me see if I can get a quick visual on when that is going to be. It's not too abysmal, but it is not a Steve Reeves movie, I can tell you that, for those of you that know the movie. June of 83. So that's 5 episodes from now. We'll be talking about Alien Worlds. Next up, The Missing Man meets the Payne family. Payne is P-A-Y-N-E. And this is a Steve Ditko presentation. It is scripted, penciled, and inked by Mr. Steve Ditko with dialogue from Robin Snyder. Colors by Steve Olaf. I believe he goes on to create Oleoptics, maybe? A coloring? Yeah, I don't know. And lettered by Andy Kubert. Dramatis personae, the missing man, and the Payne family. The Payne family is a mom, a dad, a boy, and a girl child. Now, the missing man, he's an interesting character visually. The person is a regular dude, but he can change into this very caricaturish of a human being creature, to where all you see are lines that terminate in hands, lines that terminate in feet, and enough of a visual where the head is to assume that that's where the head is. It's glasses, and it's got just ears, just mouth, just hair, but none of the fleshy components that connect all of that, if you can picture that. Yeah, so it's a very... Well, it's a very Steve Ditko kind of creation. There's another story that I'm going to be looking at in, I believe it's Silver Star, that is The Mocker, M-O-C-K-E-R. Another clearly Steve Ditko creation, although I don't think that it turns out to be, now that I say that. I believe he got the idea from something else. Yeah, I forget what I read, but anyways, sorry guys. I have the propensity to go down rabbit holes and find out a lot of stuff, but unfortunately, at my age and with some medical conditions that I have, my memory is just not as good as I would hope it be. So I remember that I should know, but I don't necessarily remember the information, if that makes sense. So I throw those things out because I do most of the stuff off the cuff, and so I apologize if it's kind of disjointed and kind of leaves you hanging because I know something, but I don't tell you, and usually I don't tell you because I don't remember, not because I'm trying to be one of those people that has information and you don't, and so, you know, those kind of people annoy me, by the way. All right, anyway, sorry, The Missing Man. This is reprinted in Steve Ditko's 80-page package. Yeah, not that kind of package. Issue number 2 from 1999, Robin Snyder and Steve Ditko, September 1999. So we see the missing man here on the first page fighting, subduing some people engaged in thuggery in the panels on the left-hand side of the page. The panels on the right-hand side of the page is a secondary story of the Payne family moving into town from parts unknown, perhaps the country, perhaps another town, we don't know. But they look rough. They look like beggars and people that have unfortunately had to live on the street for a while. Disheveled, clothing that is not in good condition any longer. All of them, three of the four have sacks of belongings. Daddy Payne doesn't because he's too good. So Mommy Payne probably is carrying her and his stuff. And let me just say that Daddy Payne is a real bell end from the beginning to the end of the story, a bell end. He's the head of the family. He keeps the family in line by threatening and physically whooping up on them. Actually, when we first run into Mom, she is sporting a black eye on the right side of her face. The kids, they don't show any overt abuse. To open their story, they're trying to squat somewhere, and the street people who are already squatting there come back in the evening, right after having plied their trade of trying to, you know, get whatever they can get to survive. Well, the Paynes are there, and the Paynes run them off. primarily by the son engaging in fisticuffs and the daughter grabbing up a broken bottle and waving it as one would a shiv, a knife. You know how that is. So they run them off. Then mom grabs a large knife machete and dad grabs a lead pipe and finishes the deal. So the Paynes now have a home base and they start pickpocketing. We see grifting, pretending that they're down and out and asking for handouts. Looks like one scene here is a carjacking. And so they just do whatever underhandedly thing they can do to get stuff from people, whether it's begging or forcibly stealing, what have you. Doesn't matter. They use all the techniques. So we spend a lot of time in the first three pages or so setting up the Paine family and seeing how they are. Until at one point, the daughter, they have noticed a very richly styled car going through near their neighborhood every day. And this particular morning, the daughter feigns unfortunateness by laying squatting in the street to block the car, to make the car stop. And when it stops, we see that it is Amos and Ma, two of the group that hangs out with Missing Man that we have seen in previous stories. And when the car stops, Amos gets out to help the little girl. Well, they fall on Amos and drag Ma out of the car. They whoop up on Amos and send him on his way because what they're going to do is they're going to hold Ma for ransom. The Paine family is. So we have a couple others here at Ma's detective agency. We have Sid and, let's see, what is her name? Toddy, T-O-D-I, Toddy, maybe, not Toddy, yeah. Maybe a woman named Toddy would be really cool. So maybe it's Toddy, like hot Toddy, although I thought that was T-O-T-T-Y. Yeah, I don't know. This is T-O-D-I, Toddy. We'll say Toddy. And Sid, S-Y-D. So they're hanging out and doing some stuff for Ma when Amos gets back and tells them of the plight. The three of them contact Missing Man, which, let me see if I can get the real dude's name here. Yeah, no, it doesn't show it, but he's, pardon me just a moment, well, because this is bothering me. No, it is Sid. Okay, that's what I thought. Sid is Missing Man. Okay. So Sid and Toddy are here. Amos comes in. Sid tells Toddy to do her computer stuff and start collating all the information to find Ma while he, Sid, runs out to get Missing Man. I thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure. Lost track there. So Missing Man goes out and he starts roughing up ne'er-do-wells to try to get a bead on the Paine family, while all of Ma's family, and I'm throwing up the finger quotes here, everybody that works with and for her is out getting information, bringing it back to Toddy, and she is feeding it into her computer, trying to collate everything to get from that side of things, the location of Ma, whereas Missing Man is out from the dark evil side of town, trying to get a bead on whoever took Ma, I should say. They don't know that it's the Paine family. We do, having read it. So Missing Man's looking for the Paine family. Ma's group is looking for information to find Ma. Every now and then, the two sides will come together. Sid, representing Missing Man, will bring in information he's got. Toddy will give him information that she has put together. We cut back to the Paine family, where we see how they're treating Ma, which is okay. We see how really messed up the Paine family is, but they're not doing anything physically to Ma. So she's trying to talk them down. They're talking their junk. It really doesn't go anywhere. We see a scene here where the young boy has found a stray cat and wants to keep it as a pet. And Pa pretty much makes it so that that can't happen by abusing the cat. So we find out, like I say, that Pa is just a total bell end. And that's the way he's written. It's not implied. It is, you see directly with him the way he speaks to and he physically treats him, the way he treats that cat, the way he talks to Ma, the way he is. So finally they get a bead on where they believe the Paine family, who they still don't know that that's their name, but the bad guys, let's say, are holding Ma. So the missing man goes, he gets in, finally he finds Ma, and as he's trying to rescue Ma, they're in a building, a tenement or what have you, that is in such bad shape that part of it collapses on people while they're there. The people being the young boy of the Payne family. So Ma is upset now, and it's kind of confusing because the wife of the Payne family, the matriarch of the Payne family, is also referred to as Ma. But the head of the detective agency that Sid hangs around with and missing man works with is also called Ma. So, yeah, there's a lot of Ma's. But the Payne mother, or the Ma, our Ma, gets upset because the Payne son is caught in the collapse of the building. So missing man takes Ma outside where she is safe and then goes back in for the boy. Well, the rest of the Payne family realize what's happened and they attack missing man, grab Ma and bring her back in, and the dad gets upset, threatens his son with a gun, and as he is in the process of shooting him, Ma throws him to the side and jumps in the, and not necessarily in the way, but is shot inadvertently instead of the young boy. Seeing that, the boy goes ape poo on the dad and just starts beating the holy heck out of him until he is able to get the pistol that the dad was wielding. He threatens the dad and he comes very, very close to shooting him until our Ma talks the young Payne down. And I'm looking for the Payne family Ma and I don't see her. I don't know. Did I lose her in the story? Did something happen to her? I'm not sure, but the Payne family is now one short, so something is happened to the mother. So the rest of Ma's detective agency get on scene. So now the Paynes are sorely outmanned, outgunned. They're subdued, held until the police get there, and then the Payne family is taken off by the police. Sid and Ma and Amos return, and the people of the agency that Ma is in charge of throw a party for her. And in amongst the people of the party is the young Payne boy who they have rescued from the rest of the family. And they find out that he has other family that is going to adopt him in a good way. And so that is ultimately what happens. The bad Payne members, who is the dad, the mother, and the daughter, go to jail. The changed Payne member, the young boy, is adopted. And Ma's detective agency personnel live happily ever after. Or until their next appearance. I think the Rocketeer has a couple more issues with Pacific Comics that we'll take a look at. All right, moving on, we will take a look at Silver Star number 2. Front cover here is a definite Kirby cover. It has Silver Star on the left-hand side looking at a big giant face that is labeled Homo Geneticus. But I believe that face is supposed to represent Darius Drum, who is the big bad in this issue. Man may destroy to gain power. His successor may destroy because he's born with it. Look out for Darius Drum. And this is a visual novel, we're told. This story of the Silver Star. Cover signed by Kirby and Thibodeau. Now, in that vein, we have some creative information here for Silver Star and some reprint info, hopefully. Let's see, what is this? Something happened. Issue number 2. This is scripted and penciled for us by Jack Kirby, inked and lettered by Mike Royer, and colored by Janice Cohen. Primary personae are Silver Star and Darius Drum. That's good guy and bad guy. Then we have other individuals, Bradford Miller, Walter Hammer, and Floyd Custer, who ultimately bites the big one this issue, who are in between. We see them all in relation to Silver Star, but of course in any particularly comic book story like this, you have questions on the good guy side as to who truly is a good guy and who is not. And that is the case with some of these individuals. Now, this story is reprinted in Jack Kirby's Silver Star issue number 1 from Image 2007. And then we have a backup story, as I mentioned, from Steve Ditko called The Mocker that we'll also talk about. So we open and we have a big face of Silver Star, which is something that I've noticed that Kirby does frequently. He starts with some individual. I know Captain Galactic, this has happened several times as well. A big head, whether the head is talking or it is involved in a conversation with smaller people on either side of it speaking. But usually the very first, not usually, but there are times that the first panel of a story is a three-quarter, 80% filled panel of a head, a face. Sometimes, as I said, a talking head. In this instance, he's just listening, or I don't even know if he's listening. He's being talked about, and he's being talked about by Bradford Miller and Walter Hammer. And his name, Silver Star's name, is Morgan. And he is a good boy, according to the doctor, who also turns out to be his father, because as we kind of learned in issue one, his father is a scientist who is trying to prepare the human race for life after the atomic bomb. And so he is genetically manipulating people. What is that? GC? Is that what it's called? Or GM, modified GM. He's making GM humans rather than just food that everybody seems to be so up in arms about currently. As they're talking, they being Bradford and Walter, they are attacked by a giant bacilla, right? Is that what they called it? Which is a kind of bacteria? Yes, overgrown bacillus. It crept in through under the door, in the crack between the door and the floor, and then it giganticized there in front of them into some big, you know, amoebic bacteria Kirby creature. And Silver Star just blows through it with flame jetting from his hand, because he can manipulate atoms. So basically, Silver Star can do anything. You know, he's the MacGuffin. He is the Mary Sue. He is the whatever you want to call it, but he can. And we find out that Darius Drum is likewise only from the evil perspective, as we would presume or assume that Silver Star is from the good perspective, the white hat. Darius Drum is the black hat. So we have some talking heads here. One of the gentlemen is, this turns out to be Floyd Custer, who is going to see Silver Star, but he is waylaid by creatures under the control command of Darius Drum, who kill the gentleman. And we see Darius here. He breaks the fourth wall. Oh, been watching, have you? Then you know that the flame of hate lies in free domain, whatever the heck that means. But he looks at us and turns and is speaking. And as he's speaking, we see that these creatures that beset and killed Floyd Custer, he created from his hands, because on his hands and his fingers, he has faces and heads and all these kind of... So he is just atomically, I guess, assembling the atoms in the forms of these creatures, you know, form of a demon creature, shape of, yeah, anyways. So that's our first introduction in this issue to Darius Drum. I think we had a mention of him last issue. I don't recall if we ever actually saw him. Maybe we did at the end, but he's here. So 3-4 pages into the story, harsh deeds and quotes from one who is far less likable than Silver Star. It's time to learn more about deadly Darius Drum. Created, written, drawn, Jack Kirby lettered, inked, Mike Royer colored, Janice Cohen. Read on. So we turn, and we have Darius here, who has gone to the car accident, and he's playing with the dead body of Floyd Custer in sending a message to Silver Star, Bradford, and Walter, that this is what I can do, and I'm going to do the same to you. Meh. Essentially is what he tells him. Silver Star gets mad, gets real pouty. We have a couple pages here where Bradford and Walter are talking about Silver Star's lack of emotional development, because even though he has these abilities to do all these things. Now, mind you, we first ran into Morgan as a soldier in the Vietnam War last issue. Well, come to find out that that soldier in the Vietnam War who was sent over there to... Well, you know, let's see. To do what soldiers from carrying a particular flag are sent to do. Okay. But yet he has the emotional stability of a much, much lesser aged individual than he was. So at least that's what we're finding out now. And Bradford goes on to explain how Darius Drum has come about, because it turns out that though Morgan is his son, Darius was the first child that he attempted to manipulate, and that was in the womb of a couple that came to him for help. There was, unfortunately, something wrong with the child, and in treating that child, the doctor treated the child with the techniques that he had been developing and using to create the next generation, the next species of humanity who will survive and thrive after the nuclear holocaust that is oncoming. So he, yeah, did some shenanigans here, and the mother and father of the child find out that the child may not be the most normal when they take him home, because as the dad is walking out of the hospital with the child swaddled, he opens the swaddling around the child's head, and we find that the child has a rather grimacing adult visage and says, "Ha ha ha, progress, change, or perhaps the Ides of March, O Caesar." Again, whatever that means, Jack Kirby, layout, plot, dialogue, I don't get it. But the dad goes off. They take him home and they raise him, and the dad turns out is leader of a weird cult that is centered and lives in a castle out in the country. The son leads a rebellion that ultimately kills the dad and burns down the castle as a child, and walks away from the devastation that he has caused whistling, and he grows up to be Darius Drum. Next scene, we see Darius directly attack the facility where Bradford, Walter, and Silver Star are. Silver Star has to rescue them, and in rescuing them, we find out that there is a Tracy Coleman frozen in time and space for 10 years, a child alive in stasis. So this is a child that they rescued from Darius and have kept in stasis. I don't know why. I guess we will, Nick, we'll find out next episode. And that basically is the end of this story. How many pages is this? 20? Yeah, about 2/3 is the Silver Star story that goes very quickly. And then 1/3 is this last Mocker story. We have an ad. Subscribe today where you can get Captain Victory, Silver Star, Gru the Wanderer, Elric of Melnibone, Twisted Tales, or Alien Worlds. All 1-year subscriptions, all 6 issues for all of them. No. Captain Victory, Silver Star, and Gru are $5.50. Elric, Twisted Tales, and Alien Worlds are $9. So apparently they have to pay more for those, whereas the others maybe are creations. I know that Twisted Tales and Alien Worlds are being put together by Bruce Jones. Elric of Melnibone, I guess they just have to pay for the rights to use the character. All right, next page is a black and white ad for some more Pacific Comics. The Rocketeer, Captain Victory, Twisted Tales, Ms. Mystic, and Star Slayer on sale in February, March. And then The Mocker, In With These Hands. The Mocker, scripted, penciled, and inked by Steve Ditko, colored by Janice Cohen, and lettered by Steve Ditko. It is reprinted in The Mocker from Snyder and Ditko 1990, and The Mocker from Snyder and Ditko in 2000. Interestingly enough, both April 1990 and April 2000, exactly 10 years apart. I have no idea why. We are told here where I am looking, which is the Grand Comics database, that the story was originally produced for editor Richard Howell's NBM line, intended for the black and white magazine Adventure Illustrated No. 1, which was advertised but never published. And this info is per Robin Snyder. The coloring, who is this? Janice Cohen. She colored the Kirby. Yeah, the coloring seems very dark-hued and very saturated. Now, I don't know if that is the color choice or is it the newsprint type of problem that we have with comics produced in 1983. Oh, also, for any of those out there that are interested, this particular book was once in the possession of Fantastic Worlds Bookstore of 581 West Campbell Road, Richardson, Texas. There's a stamp on the inside for that. So that's kind of cool. It's not where I got mine, but that's where it was once upon a time. So we have a young lady who is upset because Milo has disappeared. And she is looking around to try to find out where Milo is. And we see some really weird, almost robotic-y kind of, okay. First of all, the room that she is in has a bunch of hands statuary where the base of the statue is the wrist and the hand is upright, holding various fingers, various shaped hands and whatever all over the room. One of the hands even is in the shape of like a pointing finger, okay, on with the wrist on the base. And at the end of that pointer finger is a big circle, and it looks like it's a magnifying glass or a small clear window or something like that. Not sure if that's supposed to signify something. I know Mr. Ditko was into some stuff that maybe goes over my head a little bit. Objectivism, I think it was called. Ayn Rand and all this other. Yeah, so I don't know. He, you know, visually, though, I will say that whatever he was into helped him draw some pretty weird stuff. And this continues that trend, particularly with this character, the Mocker. But I digress. This young lady is looking for Milo in this room of hands. And then suddenly, two more hands, only these are connected to arms, long, thin, like mechanical arms and seem to be mobile, assault her and beat her down, killing her, it appears. And someone here, I will presume it's Milo, says, "But I loved her." And the person in charge of the hands, we'll say, says, "Loved? Bah, you're a weak, lusting fool, Milo." Ah, there we go. It was Milo. "You wanted her, Milo. That's all. A desire, not a passion. I understand passion and love." And Milo's thinking as he's drinking an alcoholic beverage, I would presume, "But I did love her." See, weirdness. The hands, or, well, the disembodiment from the hands continues to talk to him. And then we find later at City Hospital, only one chance to save her. Remove pressure on the brain. Now, this is a doctor, and this doctor we will go on to find out is the individual that can become the Mocker. Also, something interesting about Ditko's art in this story. Predominantly, now it does change a little bit by the end of the story. This story is 10 pages long. But predominantly, Ditko chose a 16-panel grid. Now, until, again, the last couple pages of the story, he did vary the panel sizes, either vertically or horizontally, by combining numbers of panels in that 16-panel grid, right? So he would go from one page would be 16, the next page maybe 9 panels. But you could still see the grid. The larger panels were just combinations horizontally or vertically of any number of those 16 panels. So that's it's visually different. Makes things a little bit difficult, particularly for me. I don't have the best eyesight anymore. So trying to suss out 16 panels on a standard comic book size page, 8.5 by 11, that it's tough. Well, actually, quite a bit less, because there's probably a full inch lost on the upper and lower portion of the page here from where the panels, the gutters, I guess I think you call them. So anyways, okay, sorry. We find out that Owen Peck is running for something local government, like mayor, I think it looks like. But the people who are behind him want him to run for president. And he's like, "Well, you know, let me be mayor or governor, whichever this is, first, and then we'll move on." Big campaign poster here, and from the other side of the poster, jumping through it and ripping it to pieces, is the Mocker. Now, the Mocker is a smartly dressed gentleman in a tie with a bowler, but he is colored and is like this really weird, almost, camouflage design or something. It's a really odd looking design. For those of you that really are interested in what I'm trying to describe and failing to just completely, just do a search for Ditko the Mocker, and you'll see what it's a really weird character. Not weird in the same way as the Missing Man, but weird nonetheless. So the Mocker busts through this campaign advert and tells Mr. Peck that he is going to bring him down and starts disseminating all this information that he has about how not cool Peck is. He's throwing out pictures. He's throwing out names. He's throwing out contact information of people that Peck has done wrong or unfortunate things that Peck has been involved in, and just all of these different things just to trash the character of Mr. Peck. Peck has a breakdown here while the mocker just leaves him, I guess. Let's see. Hey, that's a great idea. Owen, tear him up. That'll also destroy the negative and the past. It'll wipe out everything. A clean slate. Now none of this ever happened. So I guess he is mocking them? Yeah. We go back and we find out that the woman that the doctor had operated on has died. The husband goes bananas. We find out that there's a connection between this rich dude whose wife just died and Mr. Peck. And the doctor who is the mocker knows who they are. And there's the rich man went to Peck because Peck knew the doctor. The doctor could save the wife. Well, he didn't. So the rich man is holding Peck up by gunpoint. And in during that, the mocker busts in and just starts getting weird. He trashes the rich guy with the gun, but then knows that the rich guy is connected in a bad way, you know, like mobster connected. And so he beats up the guy to find out that connection, and he goes to that upper level mobster, confronts him, and when he grabs him, that mobster starts turning physically into this greenish, camo-ish kind of covering that is all over the mocker. And when he's about halfway covered, he just passes out. And so the mocker just bounces him off a wall and knocks him out. We end up with this... I don't know the connection. I don't know how this happened. It didn't make sense to me. Sorry, guys. Maybe if somebody has this book, they can read it, Silver Star issue number 2, and educate me, because I am uneducated at the moment. But we see the mocker. He shows up at the room at Milo's place. So Milo is connected to all of this. And he shows up at the room where Milo is, because it has all the hands. And we see the face of the individual that is also in Milo's apartment, let's say, and is behind all of the disembodied hands, or the machine man kind of hands. You know how he had those really extendable arms? And I'm sorry, I'm mixing all the different companies up. I'm just trying to draw on something that I know that you may know that, you know, is similar so that you can see what I'm looking at here. I apologize if that is failing, but that's what I'm attempting to do. And so the mocker is here and he's attacking somebody, and I can't really tell by the artwork who this person is, but he's somebody that is connected to Peck somehow. And they're in Milo's room, apartment. Milo is here also, but that's not why the mocker is here. The mockers followed the other person into Milo's apartment, runs into this dude, and we find out that the person in charge of these disembodied hands is in a metallic contraption that conceals his body up to his head. His head is sticking out of it. And all of that is in a sitting position on like a wheelchair. And then from the shoulders, because it looks like he's sitting with his arms crossed against his chest, but it's all covered up in one piece, like an iron lung kind of thing, or, you know, something like that. Coming off of that one piece, at approximately where the shoulder and the elbow would be on both sides, are these long extendable arms. So he has four of them that he could operate, I presume mentally. He also has one eye and one ear covered by some kind of contraption on his head. So he attacks the mocker with these extendable arms, and the mocker attacks him back, grabbing one of these extendable arms and changing it into this camo-y pattern, and it runs up the arm and starts to change the person controlling the mechanical arms. I'm looking here at my notes, and the name of this, here it is, Hugo Boga, H-U-G-O-B-O-G-A, two words. Hugo Boga, he's the bad guy with the extendable arms that the mocker takes out, and ultimately kills. And so thus ends all of this line of corruption from Peck all the way up to the highest levels of the controllingness of the bad guys. So ultimately, that's what the Mocker was out to do, was to get rid of evil. He had located Peck, and he traced back all of the evil influences on Peck all the way back up the line to the main person in charge, Hugo Boga, and he killed them all. And thus ends the story of the Mocker. I apologize if that's not a very good description of that story. For those of you that may know the story, write in. Explain the story better, and I'll explain it on the next show, and we can all be on the same level of knowing what in the heck went on here, because I am very confused. All right, inside back cover of this issue, we have a black and white advert for the art of Al Williamson, the first major retrospective of one of comic art's all-time greats. It'll include a 14,000-word interview with Williamson. Dude. And on the back cover is a full-color advert for Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers issue number 10, which will be coming up here in a month or two of Tuesdays, and I will talk about it as well. All right, so that will end this particular file of coverage. Stay tuned here in a couple minutes. The next part will drop, which will start with my looking at Star Slayer issue number 6. Ciao, Bella, back in a second.